input. We have 13 folks that wish to share with us, and I think all of you know the rules. 3 minutes, the buzzer goes off, and no, it's not five, Jim. It's three. Now you're down to 2.5. I don't know. So I'll call you up two at a time, and we'll rotate through. So we'll start off Dennis and Dave Hedrick, please. So kick us off, Dennis.
Yes. Chair Smith, members of the commission, Director Storr, and Deputy Director Windrup, thank you for this time. I'm Dennis DeSilvas. I'm representing the Conservation Committee of Tahoma Audubon Society today. And yesterday's excellent presentation by Megan West during the working session solidified, at least in my mind, answers to some of the questions I've had from my folks and concerning what the department was doing insofar as H.R. 4647, the Recovering America's Wildlife Act, the RAWA bill. Thanks to Ms. West, I have access to that presentation. Yesterday, during Nate Pamplin's presentation, Vice Chair Carpenter asked the question, what can the commission do to help him during the budgeting exercise? So I want to turn that around and ask the same sort of question of the commission regarding the RAWA. What can we, on this side of the table, do to help support this game-changing piece of legislation? When it comes time, and hopefully sooner than later, are there certain congressional representatives we should contact? Are there state legislature folks that we should correspond with to urge them to contact congressional folks? In short, and thinking out of the box, what can we do to help? Another item related to this this legislation, Commissioner Baker asked what I thought was a very telling question, and I'm paraphrasing, and I hope I'm getting this right, Commissioner. Will this bill mean that drilling and mining will expand on public lands? That, Commissioners, is a definite showstopper for my folks. I've already talked with them about this. So that's about it on that. Oh, I got a couple moments left, and different subject. After hearing the presentation yesterday about the variety of passes needed for recreational areas in Washington, the Discover Pass and others, I urge you, please do everything you can to support a Three Musketeers Pass. You know what I mean. One for all for one. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dennis. And as we mentioned yesterday, we requested briefings from Megan through AFWA on status of that. So I would say monitor our website, and then as this unfolds, how we will look to the public for assistance, we'll let you know. But stay tuned on that.
Thank you.
And Jim Sutton, please. And Dave.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I appreciate it. I'd like to talk today about accountability when it comes to Wolf Plan implementation. When the plan was adopted by the commission in December of 2011, there was much uncertainty about how recovery would actually take place on the ground. If you listen to the audio of that meeting, which I would encourage each and every one of you to do, one thing that was stressed over and over was the need to adapt as things changed on the ground, as things appeared. That need for adaption seems to have been lost on the department and this commission. I'm talking specifically about recovery in the state and the disproportionate number of wolves in Northeast Washington as it relates to recovery. I've been trying to bring this issue forward with the department for several years with no success. While talking with Francine Madden, a person that I've communicated frequently with last winter, trying to get this issue on the WAG agenda, she finally bluntly told me, and this is a quote, "Nobody really cares that Northeast Washington has a few extra wolves." I initially found that very offensive, but have since come to realize that she was just giving me the cold, hard truth. That's what I've found when it comes to the department and the commission. While listening to the director's reports and reports by the Wolf Policy Lead and reading the annual reports, I've heard no specific concern about the overload of wolves in Northeast in relation to recovery. Commissioner Thornburn did approach the subject at the last update by the Wolf Policy Leads, but I felt her questions went unanswered and there was really no follow-up by anybody else on the commission. There is currently legislation to translocate wolves from Northeast and has gotten some support. While I'm happy for the light on this issue, the legislature is a poor place to develop wildlife policy. The rural places that have the rural places that wolves are going to inhabit have little political power, and this has always been a source of a great deal of anxiety for that group. The wolf plan was put into place after much comment and heartburn from the people throughout this state, and is far from perfect, and has many uncertainties. When the plan was adopted, the need for adaptation was stressed. The commission and department needs to be responsible and accountable for that adaptation. To hand that responsibility to the legislature and potentially the courts is a guarantee that wolf recovery in Washington will be an epic failure.
Thank you, Dave.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, Joe, I'm sorry.
Mr. Hedrick, thank you for those comments. I want to assure you that we think a lot about the where the wolves are, where the impacts are. I mean, we've spent the majority of our time in terms of looking at conflict issues, allocating resources, talking to legislators, county commissioners in the Northeast. So I don't want you walking away without at least hearing us say that's dynamic in this whole recovery plan. That's been a challenge for everybody, and we understand the people up there that are making those sacrifices and are you know among the front line in terms of trying to build this appropriate balance between people needs and animal needs, and we'll keep doing that as we go forward. So
I'm fortunate enough to be one of the people that gets talked to once in a while up there, and talk to county commissioners and all that. I think, why I put that in this was the frustration that nobody really feels like it actually gets to the director and the commission level. There's a lot of frustration there, but we never actually see it, actually verbalized to this body. And I think that's where the frustration comes.
Thank you. Commissioner Thornburn.
I feel that frustration, I have to say, as a commissioner from the area. The Northeast Washington, as Dave pointed out, there were assumptions made about recovery. To me, the Northeast Washington population is simply part of a recovered population. And yet we still put it forward as endangered because we're not making the adjustments that we said we would in the plan. We're in a very slow process with WAG, and I know this is what our wolf policy person would like to use, but there's a lot going on right now with rural communities feeling unrepresented, and I do think there's a commission responsibility here to take a look at it again. I feel the same frustration that Dave is expressing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What, Commissioner Keough?
Yeah, this is on March agenda, right?
The update.
So I think that might be an opportunity for commissioners maybe to weigh in more, and I'd like to hear. Dave, I too hear your frustration. We're not able to act. I mean, I've talked to Donnie a little bit. There are certain challenges about relocating wolves to the side of the mountains, as you probably are aware.
Huge challenges.
But that doesn't mean that we can't maybe adapt the policy without, you know, really using relocation as a tool. I'm certainly open as a commissioner to hear more about it and continue the discussion. Bear with us, I guess.
We'll be looking at that next month.
Yeah.
So,
thank you again.
Thank you, Martha. Please, and Jim, it's up to you, buddy.
Good morning, Chair Smith, commissioners, and acting director, and Ms. Windrup. I'm Jim Sutton. I am the past president of the Inland Northwest Wildlife Council of Region 1. That's where we reside at, very close to District 1. This is also a past president, Leonard Wolf, of the same council, and we represent quite a chunk of people over there. And it's ironic that we're going to follow the discussion that just happened, but we have maybe an idea or hopefully a solution to some of the problems. In 2010, Washington State adopted a wolf recovery plan, and by the end of 2016, the state was home to a minimum of 115 documented wolves. The majority of packs located in the Northeast, referred to as Hunting District 1, feeding these wolves require a significant increase of ungulate consumption, specifically moose, elk, and deer. And during the past 7 years, populations of other primary predators in those same areas have largely remained stable. This point refers to black bear and cougars residing in Hunting District 1. The increase of predators results in more predation upon ungulates. It takes more protein to feed more predators. That's a fact. With the documented 28% increase per year of wolves, primarily in Hunting District 1, and at least 28% more ungulates have to be eaten by the wolves. Now, don't get me wrong, this is not a wolf bashing session here, okay? We're just stating some facts. This has a detrimental impact on the ungulate herds, and WDFW District 1 report shows a 22% reduction of deer in the 2016 harvest. In order to reduce negative predation by the wolves, bears, and cougars in those GMUs, mitigation should also include reducing black bear and cougar populations. According to the WDFW, the statewide black bear population is around 25,000 to 30,000 bears. And the cougar is also estimated to be around 2,000 to 3,000 cougars, excluding yearlings and kittens. We, the Inland Northwest Wildlife Council, are recommending two proposals, making the 2018 spring black bear season an open tag only. That would eliminate the permit drawing for Hunting District 1 from April 1st to June 15th. As opposed to the existing lottery drawing. We also recommend that cougar quotas for Hunting District 1 be increased by a minimum of 50% for the next 3 years. Now, due to the difficulty in making accurate ungulate and predator counts, both of these options should be reevaluated annually to analyze the results. We urge you, the Commission, to implement our proposals for the 2018-2020 seasons. Increasing the spring black bear and cougar harvest, as suggested, would provide the following five benefits. Okay, immediate relief to the moose and elk cows during the critical birthing season when bears have the biggest detrimental impact. May I please finish the other four?
Very quickly.
Okay. Highly affected predation areas would receive more human traffic, reducing excessive calf predation, and positive economic benefit for the Northeast Washington towns from hunting and tourism. And it would also promote positive relations with the residents in Northeast Washington most affected by the wolf packs. And this would also generate additional revenue for the WDFW via the spring bear tags.
Okay, thank you.
Well done.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Yeah. Just real quick. Did you turn in would you turn in a written recommendation about what you just described?
You have copies. Okay. Everybody should be getting a copy of this.
Okay.
So that way you can see it. And then there are bullet points on here and references to where we got that information from the WDFW to surpass.
That'll help our help numbers. With next month's discussion.
Thank yes. you. Okay.
Thanks, Jim.
Sure.
And Dick Shanks and Martha.
So I own and train an Irish Water Spaniel. He is both an upland bird dog and a waterfowl retriever, and he's also my working wildlife dog in my work with Swans, the agency. And I have and continue to use both the Cherry Valley and the Crescent Lake Wildlife areas for hunting dog training. I support the need to have public land to train hunting dogs. I also am a longtime member of the Snoqualmie Wildlife Area Advisory Committee. Formerly, the WDFW had citizens advisory groups for its wildlife areas. The state changed directions, going from a citizen advisory group to a more diverse and inclusive advisory committee format statewide. This is really good, and I really commend the agency for doing this. And but you have heard only one side of the hunting dog story at this point in time. And we continue on this same course until the issue of the hunting dog training is openly discussed with all user groups, and how the dog training needs fit with WDFW's wildlife area's broader plan and the WDFW's mission. So, the commission assisted in the co-opting of due process at your March 2017 meeting. And what I'm referring to is the Snoqualmie Wildlife Area Management Plan is under revision, and it has been for about a year and a half. And we're in that planning process, and the advisory committee that was renew informed goes with the whole vision of what this agency wanted to do when you created that process back in 2014 with that document. And then somehow in our advisory committee, the hunting dog group wanted a subcommittee, which we gave them, the agency supported that, and we agreed. And we had a subcommittee meeting. During the second meeting of that group, I was there and I'm on the subcommittee. A subgroup formed, and they went somewhere else. At that moment in time, staff directed Brian Bame, the wildlife area manager, who's an amazing, amazing person, and I totally, really appreciate him, to not talk to the advisory group about what is really going on. So we were shut out of the process. Our own subcommittee will not be allowed to discuss it. Memos were sent, all kinds of things were going on, and the whole group was left in the dark. Meanwhile, all the other user groups are being left behind, and discussions are not happening within that management planning process. So the process has been co-opted, completely co-opted. And this is not acceptable, in that we need to go back to the planning process that was created by the agency to work with these wildlife areas and to create a management plan that takes into account all user groups. So that's why I'm bringing this forward, and I will be submitting some written comments to you in what I think needs to happen. But the agency needs to send it back to the local level, to Region 4, back into the process of the wildlife area planning process, and let that continue and be discussed with all user groups, come to some consensus, and come back out and have it reviewed. Excellent. And that's what I'm asking.
Thank you, Martha. Appreciate that. And William McLennan, please, and Dick.
Hi, my name's Dick Shanks. I'm the president of the Laidlaw Island Hunting Club. I'm here to comment about the proposed property acquisition by the department. It's referred to as the Grayland property. Just a little background. We're a waterfowl hunting club. We were established in 1923, so we're coming up on 100 years of existence there. We're located adjacent to the proposed Grayland property acquisition. We share somewhere between 1.5 and 2 miles of a property line next to the property the department's looking at acquiring. We generally support the department's acquisition of this property, but we do have some concerns. One is access to our property, the Laidlaw property, and the other is the interface between public use and private land use. Regarding the access, the department, part of the procurement is what's referred to as the Dyke Road, and that road is the only access to our upland property. We've used this access since 1923. We've had continuous vehicle access over this road since it was improved to use vehicles. We perform maintenance on this road over the years, and again, it's necessary for us to maintain vehicle use over this road in order to use our property and maintain our property. The other area we have concerns about is the interface between public and private land use. We only hunt 3 days a week, Wednesdays, Saturdays, and Sundays. So that respects the resource, gives the chance for the waterfowl to rest, which respects the resource and improves our hunting quality. It's consistent with the way the National Wildlife Refuge offers hunting opportunities on their properties. And we're concerned about the dike use, road use by the public. The dike road is right, as it's referred to as a dike road, is adjacent to the estuary. We have several blind sites that are within eyesight of that road, very close to it. We're concerned about if there's lots of public use on that road, what it's going to do is disturb the ducks, chase them away, and there won't be any hunting in these blind sites. So we're confident that if we can work collaboratively with the department, these issues can be resolved. At this point, we've not been contacted by the department to discuss this at all. So we'd ask the department to get a hold of Laidlaw Island Duck Club and review these situations with us and see if we can come up with a win-win situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Dick. And I think that if can we have your comments too?
Sure. This is submitted to.
Oh, it is okay. We'll make sure they
apologize for some typo errors. But
oh, that's all right. We'll make sure that those do get relayed. And your points are well taken. Yeah, Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question. You stated early in your points that it was a waterfowl hunting club, and then you talked about the road taking you up to your upland area.
It's upland water. So we have two waterfowl hunting areas. One is in the estuary, tidal influenced. The other, we have some upland property that is sheet water, rainwater flooded, that also has some hunting blind sites.
Where in Grayland is this located approximately?
Do you know where Brady's Oysters is on the highway to Westport?
Yeah.
Right across the street. And again, we share that dike road is basically the property line between the proposed acquisition and ours, and so there's about a mile and a half of property line there.
Thank you.
Yep.
And Joe Durham, please. And William?
Thank you to the commissioners for letting me speak this morning. I am the Secretary Treasurer of Laidlaw Island Hunting Club, and I want to just add my comments to Dick's. The 1923 founders of Laidlaw Island Hunting Club were some of the first and true conservationists. 65 original members recognized the Elk River Estuary as a unique waterfowl and wildlife habitat worth preserving. They each put in $100 to purchase the property, no small capital investment in 1923. We have been good stewards of the land, improving and maintaining the habitat for waterfowl and other wildlife since 1923. In the 1990s, the Department of Natural Resources confiscated 25 acres of timber from Laidlaw property for marmalade habitat. Timber worth over $100,000 at that time, with no compensation to Laidlaw whatsoever to this date. As a member of the Laidlaw Island Hunting Club, we look forward to sitting down with the Department of Fish and Wildlife to address issues of all local stakeholders, and specifically Laidlaw, for property access and private and public interface with the Grayland land acquisition. We do support the Department of Fish and Wildlife in this project and would like to be an active participant in that proposal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. And Bill Osborne, please, and Joe.
Good morning, Commission, WDFW staff. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to come and speak before you this morning. I'm on here to speak on behalf of the recreational community about the Wyandotte mitigation and the lack of WDFW to get the mitigation moving forward to completion. And I will say shame on the Commission and the staff for the statements that you're going to hear. There's been a committee of three and two advisors that have met with staff since the mid-1990s. There have been many proposals presented, and none have come to be finalized. We have been told time and time again more of interested parties have disagreed with the plan. Quinault Indian Nation has been said to object. Tacoma Public Utilities has been said to object. Then NEMPS, then PFMC, then the Army Corps of Engineers, then FERC, and others. We have been asked time and again. We have asked time and again for their replies to the plan and have never received an answer. I have asked to be allowed to communicate with the Quinault Indian Nation. I've been told time and time again that WDFW is our voice, and we are not to communicate with them on the mitigation issue. It is my opinion that WDF staff working on the mitigation issue have continually fed us misinformation and kept us in the dark. In the years 2012 through 2017, at this very February Commission meeting, the Commission heard from myself and others about the problem of settling the mitigation. Records will show that at least three of the last few years, the Commission directed WDFW staff to get this issue settled. I am here again and will make this point. If there is no positive movement today and direction to solve the problem, it is my opinion that the Commission has no plan to settle the mitigation again. Shame on you. That leaves us at least myself, with no option but to contact the Quinault Nation and seek a meeting with their staff to discuss what WDFW staff have been telling us for the last couple of decades. Ask what it would take to get their agreement for the mitigation to be completed. Personally, I believe WDF staff have continually lied to us. I feel some involved should lose their jobs or at least be moved from this issue. If I must name the names, I will do so to the Fish Commission. I will say that since early fall this year, I have been waiting for a reply from Region 6 Fish Program Manager from the Quinault's reply from the last proposal that was presented to them. After several requests, I still have no reply from the Region 6 Fish Program Manager. There are several line items proposed in that plan that I have problems with. Spending mitigation funds on the items that should fall under the hatchery management, state paid hatchery management, and the 35% of the money, which is roughly $2.5 million plus, I believe, by now, withholdings. Today, the Grays Harbor Management Plan we'll be discussing Grays Harbor. I would ask that the Commission would direct staff to have answers to our questions and give WDFW a deadline for completing a mitigation. There's much more I could say, but I will tell you this, and I'll leave you with this thought. Everything that we've presented since 1994 to the WDFW staff comes from within the guidelines of the draft proposal for the Wyandotte hydropower going in. At that time, the Quinault Department fisheries head fisherman signed that document. And if you got my thick packet last year, which I don't think was handed to you because I gave it to the gal outside and I didn't see that you got it. Hope you got it. Take a look at it. And if you have questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Thank you, Joe. Yeah, Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe and Amy, it is true what Joe was saying, that the Commission has provided guidance to the Department a number of years about this issue, and I'm not putting words in anybody's mouth, but I believe we were told that this thing's going to get moving. I guess I'd really like to know maybe at a convenient time soon where we are on this and what the pathway forward may be, because it is sort of rhetorical.
Mr. Durham, I know this has been a very frustrating, long-standing issue to the point that, as Commissioner Carpenter said, a year or so ago, we put together work plans. I think we had a top seven issues, and we put together work plans, and we've been working hard to move those forward. Many of those seven have been resolved. This is one that hasn't. I know that we, as Mr. Durham said, have submitted a proposal to the Quinaults, and we've been waiting for some time for a response to that proposal. But we'd be happy to come and brief you on the details. I don't know the details of the proposal right off the top of my head. I do know that there have been inquiries as to status, to the nation, in terms of their thoughts about the project. But we'd be happy to come and talk. I don't think, Mr. Durham, I know you're frustrated, but I don't think anybody intends to deceive or to lie. But trying to move this forward has been a huge challenge for us, frankly.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. Okay. And Cindy Olson, please. And Bill Osborne.
As some of you know, I've been here before. But before I start, I do want to congratulate the four commissioners that just got confirmed. Congratulations to that. And Joe, congratulations in your new position. I hope you got a thick skin.
Thank you.
Okay? My name is Bill Osborne. I'm from Aberdeen, Washington, and I'm going to follow up Joe. Joe and I have spent lots of time over the years working with WDFW to try to get the mitigation taken care of. Don, you took some of the fire out of my presentation. I was going to start with Governor Inslee ran on a platform of efficiency and transparent government. He believes in not using executive privilege to withhold records. This department doesn't have a very good record as far as being open with the public. I'm going to tell you that. Just a side note, I got a PDR going now. I can't believe I would do that. I just wanted about 10 questions asked. It's been 6 or 7 months of getting the information, and it's unbelievable the stuff I have to go through to get the questions answered. And relative to the Fish Committee, one of the questions I asked, can I find out the members of the Fish Committee? I was told I can't have that. Really? I'm telling you, I got it back in my emails at home. Bill, can't tell you that who's on that committee. Okay?
These two, me.
Well, there's somebody from DFW is on it too. I'll guarantee you that.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay? Actually, I asked Tammy to pass out some stuff. And I hope you read it, because I'm a retired school teacher, so there will be a little quiz coming up here pretty soon. Okay? So now I get the humor into it, and some of you know about this, but there are two members in here because I didn't make my presentation last year. That's Bill Osborne's can. WDFW has been kicking the can down the road on Wynoochi mitigation for 25 years. I was 52 years old when they signed the agreement, so you can tell, add 25 to that, that's higher math, that's 77 years old, and nothing has been done. Not one fish has been put in the Wynoochi. Not one thing has been done as far as maintenance from that the DFW wants to get done, and there's as Joe said, there's 2.4 million sitting there. And I'd sure try to spend it. I mean, I hear all the budgetary problems out of Olympia, and I can't believe there hasn't been a more active move to get something done in Grace Harbor. I understand the Wynoochee is one short river, but I hope you took a look at this. And one more thing before I go, and I follow up Joe, Region 6 has been a bitch to work with. I'm going to tell you that. Okay, and I've been working email-wise. That's what I taught in the school. I do everything email-wise. I would like to see the commission send a directive to Region 6 to keep Joe, Durham, Dave Hamilton, and myself apprised of anything that they are doing relative to Wainucci mitigation. There's somebody in fish management down there that does not like to do anything paper-wise because that creates a paper trail. And I'm going to tell you, I need something. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir.
Pick up the quiz on the way out. Thank you very much.
Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the gentleman testifying, but in Port Angeles, I learned about a Joe's list at the end of the meeting where we talk about a few things, and I wondered if this mitigation debt might be an opportunity to ask a few more questions on the that were have been raised for these last two gentlemen's testimony.
Good. Thank you. Yes. And Jim Olson, please. So I imagine you guys are related.
I would like to thank the commission for allowing our group to be here today. I'm Cindy Olson, and I represent the Washington Sporting Club Training Association. And on February 3rd, we sent all of you a rather detailed report of our impasse with Region 4. As of Monday of this week, we had a little bit of what we call a breakthrough in that Fenner Yarbrough gave me a call and let me know that he was planning on allowing us to have our 2018 dog training season in the valley, on Cherry Valley, and that we would start up our talks again where we left off with Russ Link in November of last year at the point in time he retired. So we're pretty excited about that. And after discussing all the various things that we need to follow up on throughout 2018, we're very cautiously optimistic about what is going to go on for the next year. However, I also have additional news from Amy this morning. We weren't sure who was going to replace Amy with Region 4, and she's assured us that we'll probably see her face back there again in about 6 months or so. So hopefully that will be the case, but she said they are, you know, preparing to work with us on the dog training problems or issues with regard to Cherry Valley. I would take some time, or I would like to be able to have some meetings maybe with the region and Martha to go through some of the lack of clarity with what we're doing and what we're asking for versus the wax issues. So hopefully at some point in time in the near future we'll have an opportunity to do that. In the meantime, we very much thank you all for your continued support of our attempt to reopen the dog training and the historical grounds throughout the units in Cherry Valley. Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. Jim, you're going to be in trouble if you say anything that goes against that. And Barbara Hawley, please. Jim, it's up to you.
Welcome, Commissioners. My name is Jim Olson. I'm a member of Rainier Hunting Retriever Club. And Fenner had called our president and reiterated to him basically what Cindy said, that they're going to work with us. We'll have our 65 acres. One of the things that concerned us last year, they gave us a 65 acres to work for dog training, but the farmer got in there and he found out that part of the area that he had been assigned to raise corn on was too wet, so he planted the corn right down the middle of our training area, which in essence took away 65 acres down to somewhat less than that. The other problem we seem to have with the, most of our problems have been with the farmer, but I was out there mowing. I did some mowing for Brian Baines to help to keep the cost down in the deal. And I'm going through this canary grass. It's 6-7 feet tall, and I couldn't see the tractor. And all of a sudden, I get burning eyes and a real metallic taste in my mouth. So I've got a little ways away where I can see it happen. They'd brought a sprayer in, and they'd sprayed the Roundup around the countryside down there. So I took off on the tractor, and I went over there and met him when he was getting ready to load his tractor. And he goes, "Well, don't worry. It's only Roundup." And I had to look him straight in the eye and said, in 1969, they told me it was only a defoliant and it wouldn't hurt us. Well, I'm one of the last ones left in that unit. So it kind of pissed me off a little bit. Also, one of the members was running her dog, and she didn't know that they had just sprayed, so he ran right across. This place had just been sprayed with Roundup. The dog now has severe intestinal problems. You know, you can't prove it was Roundup because Monsanto says their product is pure. So, anyway, the property needs to, when they spray like that, the property does need to be posted before and after, so that the public, the general public who uses this public land can get into it. And again, I'd like to thank the commissioners for listening to us and putting up with us.
Well, well raised point. And Al Schumacher, please, and Barbara with a bad wing.
Oh, two more weeks left.
Thank God.
I can't burn him, so I may just run over him. Good morning, Good morning, commissioners. Thank you for letting us come back again. My name is Barbara Hawley. I'm a member of the Washington Sporting Dog Training Association, which was formed to bring all the clubs in the state of Washington under one hat when we had trouble with our training grounds, Cherry Valley, and the other Snoqualmie Valley wildlife areas that historically have been used for dog training, hunting, and such events. I began training in Cherry Valley in 2001. I've titled seven master hunters, two of which are master national dogs. It's a hobby. It is not a livelihood. We've been accused by some of the people in WDFW of making money. There is no money to be made. I'm a member of the Puget Sound Labrador Association and the Rainier Hunting Club. Those are not-for-profit organizations. We put on picnic trials, hunting tests, field trials. It's for the joy of training and running a dog, what we learn about ourselves and our dogs. It's from these dogs that we obtain the breeding stock that fans out into the United States and other areas that become service dogs that do amazing work as bomb-sniffing, drug-sniffing. They're able to detect diabetes. And there's two studies going on currently for cancer. These hunting dogs are capable of smelling over 500,000 odors and identifying them. They're remarkable animals. I've personally witnessed a judge shut down a trial because her hunting dog, 200 yards away, started to scream and yell because she was going into diabetic shock. She walked up the hill, went to the truck, gave herself a shot, and returned and continued with the trial. As you've heard my colleagues, we are very much encouraged with the recent developments that have happened, and we hope they continue. We've come before you before, as you know, and we've had countless of meetings, discussions, phone calls, and conferences. Cindy Olson single-handedly has put together packets for you, which I believe you've gotten. We have been committed to opening up this area again. And we worked with Russ Link extensively last year to form a pilot program, only to discover when he retired that we were shut down again. We ask that these grounds be put forth into our venue of training our dogs. We realize there are other stakeholders, but there's no other stakeholder that has volunteered as we have to train and be trained by Russ Link, go out and mow countless of hours that Jim Olson and other people in our group has done. Nobody else has done that. We've been committed 100% to continuing this sport so future generations would be able to have it. Cherry Valley was closed in 2012, as you may remember, for a water wheel project. The water wheel project was completed in a couple of years, and the gates remained locked. We met countless times, were promised. And in that process, we were insulted with dogs and wildlife don't mix, which I just heard in a February meeting this year from Brian Boehm, or that we made a lot of money, or that we have litter. There's drug problems on the properties. People come in and do whirlies on the properties. I have never seen a drug problem, a whirly, or anything done. So I'd like to let you know something. We're very committed, 3,000-strong people across the state. We want to see this sport continue because it's very, very important. We do not want to see us turn out against bias against us. And you must remember, the public lands has a lease summary for the farmer that tends to favor him. But in that lease, it states, the area is managed primarily as a pheasant release site, waterfall hunting dog area, and dog training area for the wildlife viewing conservation activities. We want to maintain that. We are not going to go away. The next time I come before you, I'll be bringing a Labrador, who is a master hunter, a master national title dog, and she is a service dog as well. We are committed to maintaining these breeds. Thank you very much. I hope I don't have to come and see you again.
As a person who is owned by an English setter, I understand.
I guess I want to ask Amy, or maybe thank Amy. A couple of weeks ago, it appeared that, the train was kind of on the side of the track, and whatever you did, it sounds like it worked well, and thank you for that.
Yeah, we did. We talked with Amy about all of this last week, so we, Commissioner Carpenter and I did in Region 4. Thank you, and take care of your wing there. Elizabeth Dolphin, please. And Al?
My name is Al Schmouder. I'm here to represent the Chinook salmon that come up Chambers Creek and a lot of folks in Pierce County in our Chambers Creek watershed. I gave you some written comments electronically, but after listening to your meeting yesterday, your workshop, I came away enlightened. You guys have got some great ideas. You want to promote love for the department. You want to meet with students. You want to engage these youths. You want to move the bar a little bit so people come here. This lady should be getting an award for things they're doing. Non-consumptive person, trying to do the right things, protect the resource. You're on the right track. You've got to turn this department around. But it's not going to be a cakewalk. It's going to be damn hard to do, working with the wolves and all the things you got to do with. But it's time to take some action. We've heard all the things you want to do. You know what to do. I'd like to offer you an opportunity. Why don't you go to a large watershed, like Chambers Watershed, 300,000 plus people. They buy licenses. They don't buy licenses. They have Audubon. They got fly fishers. But they got a problem. Over the last 10 years, we spent about $13 million to keep the watershed pristine as best as we can, the urban stuff. We worked on our stormwater. We bought open space. We worked on habitat. But we got a problem. Fish and Wildlife is not a good neighbor with us. They have a 17-year policy of killing all the Chinook that come up Chambers Creek. What they do in July, they close the two fish ladders, stop all the fish, including coho. The coho they pass upstream, the Chinook they kill. Well, what do they do with these fish? Well, in 2017, we had, 230 fish come back. 40 of them were spawned. That's all they needed. 23 died in the trap. And 163 were surplused. That means we sell them to the contractor. He makes cat food out of it. In 17, last year, we had only 69 fish come back. 37 died in the trap because there's not enough oxygen. 17 were spawned. And 14 were surplused. Now, Mr. Chairman, I would like to have you ask Mr. Storr, our director, to come back in 1 month from now and tell you how he can get two Chinook salmon upstream in Clover Creek to spawn naturally. Just two. We don't want a big high standard, so we want something that they can successfully achieve. So two should do the job. Now, Clover Creek Council is going to give you $200. $100 for each fish. One mama and one papa. You get those two fish upstream, and here's $200, and I'll give the chair, and this is, to seal the deal.
What we're trying to do is develop love for the department.
You spelled my name wrong.
Let's do something.
Right.
Get two fish upstream. Not a hard job.
Thanks, Al. The glove has been thrown. So stay tuned. When they were cleaning up the Hudson River back in the day, this is about 30 years ago, one of the folks running for the U.S. Senate there actually bought a salmon, took it up, a dead one, and was saying, claiming credit for helping clean up the Hudson, but he got busted on that. So we won't take an Atlantic salmon and put it up Chambers Creek for him.
No.
Okay. So, Robert, you're the last, and Elizabeth, you're up.
I'm Elizabeth Dolphin, a lifelong resident of Western Washington. For the last 6 years, I volunteered for Heaven's Sake Wildlife Rescue. I've seen thousands of animals come in, many of them in real poor condition, and I've seen them be taken wonderful care of, seen them be rehabilitated and released. Many were not released. They couldn't be, but that's the way it is when you're in that business. I've known David and Claudia many, many times to stay up till 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning trying to save one baby squirrel or one tiny junco or one tiny possum. They are dedicated and law-abiding people, and I know them to be really good people in that respect. What happened this fall at For Heaven's Sake Wildlife Rescue is disturbing to me, and it was unnecessary, very unnecessary. It's real hard to be a volunteer under these kind of circumstances. It's just really a shame what happened. Anyway, many animals have come through there, and they've always had strict policies on how to treat and handle the animals, how not to habituate them to people, how to keep them wild. Keeping them wild is one of our main high things, other than just releasing them is a high goal, but keeping them wild is a very top goal. I'm really saddened by what happened, and I hope there's repercussions going on still. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth, and I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but we are, the WDFW is seeking applicants to serve on a new advisory group responsible for reviewing state rules governing wildlife operations. So subsequent to the events that you mentioned, we are forming an advisory group made up of people in the profession and some citizens. So that process is underway, and I'm referring to a press release as of Thursday. So. We heard all of those concerns, and things are rolling there. Thank you. Robert, you got it, buddy.
Before I start my clock, I'm going to be referring to what I think Tammy shared with you on the chart that's on here.
Okay.
So, if you have it. Thank you. I'm Robert Studar from Longview, a commercial advisor for the Columbia. I testified recently to the commission that the reason the upriver fisheries didn't have any opportunity to harvest spring Chinook in 2017 was because the new Columbia River policy failed to properly direct the managers on how to distribute allowable ESA impacts between the user groups. Simply taking harvest opportunity away from the commercial fishery and redirecting it to the recreational fishery doesn't necessarily create a better fishery, as evidenced by last year's results. So the table, what I put together here was I showed a little bit of the recent history of how the impacts are shared, and also the okay, great. I guess there's a bigger blue copy, and also the different buffers. So before the policy, we had other working groups, and we developed a matrix that adjusted the sharing ratio between recreational commercial fishermen based on the Willamette run and the upriver run. So it was a sliding scale and varied as each of those runs varied. There was also a catch balance buffer to protect the tribes because they weren't getting an opportunity to catch their 50%. So there was a 30% catch balance buffer, and there was also a commission buffer, which tended to shift some of our fishery into May, and it also protected the recreational fishery in that regard by limiting some of the early season harvest. So those values changed as the policy went through, but last year the catch balance buffer stayed, but there was no commission buffer. And I think that's the reason that the upriver fishery didn't get any harvest last year, is because you eliminated one of the buffers that was there to protect later fisheries. So We're at the point now where the manager is starting to discuss how they're going to utilize the upriver harvest this year. Obviously, we don't have much to speak of there anymore, but regardless, you're still going to be faced with the issue of whether or not there's enough fish for the upper river fisheries besides the lower river fisheries. And I think you need to look at that commission buffer and whether that should still be in place to provide that sort of guaranteed distribution by holding back the lower river fishery. The only reason that we didn't go over on the recreational harvest last year was because the run had a little bit of a surge at the end, but still the lower river used up all the buffer. So the managers are calculating the harvest quotas for the various user groups in 2018 right now. They are doing their work without any commission buffer. And that is setting the stage for another limited season above Bonneville if the run comes in short again. And I don't have any reason to think that you won't be struggling with that, looking at how the other runs have come in and the opportunity the sea lions have to take significant chunks out of that harvest. In addition, Idaho has frequently testified at the compact meetings that they don't like that 45-day early season, which is one of the goals in the policy for the lower river. They think it improperly targets some of the Idaho stocks. And last year, Bill Twite told you that 7 of the 13 Idaho hatcheries didn't make their escapement. And I think that's a reflection of that management scheme. We have a 3,000 fish Willamette quota this year for the commercial fishery. We have no way to harvest it because of the way you're distributing those impacts. I think your approach of just moving impacts around is not the way to create a fishery that works for everybody.
Thank you, Robert.
Can I just make a comment?
Yes, we'll start you.
Thank you, Robert. I always appreciate your thoughtful testimony. I'd just like to note that some of us think the upper river starts at McNary Dam.
Okay. Well. Regardless, you know, I mean, if you focus on a four, last year they had 50 days in the lower river, but there was nothing up above because they kept working on that quota.
Mr. McIsaac.
Chairman, I'm not quite sure I understand the commission buffer. Could you briefly describe what looked to me in my innocent eyes as 20% of the recreational quota and 40% of the commercial quota going into some sort of upriver buffer commission?
It's delayed until after the run-up date in May. And so basically you have a buffer, a 30% catch balance buffer, which reduces the overall run, which often reduces the actual impacts available based on that lower run value. And then, after you split it up between commercial and recreational, 20% of the recreational impacts and 30% of the or 40% of the commercial impacts were also held in reserve as an additional buffer until after the run update. And that was an additional guarantee that there would be enough fish throughout for all user groups, basically. And then if the run came in, then there was there were significant harvest opportunities for both user groups later on.
Thanks, Robert. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Always a pleasure to hear from you.
I'm sure.
Oh, well, it is. It is. I don't say that to everybody, you know. And.